We still have his books on cinema, and we all await his forthcoming update of his imperative book, 50 Years of American Cinema, now updated to 100 years. Round Midnight appeared this month as part of the Criterion Collection's April releases and is number 1,122 in the series. Thanks for listening to Community Radio, KBOO Portland. Film at 11 will be back next Friday, so until then, keep watching the screens.
KBOO is in the middle of our annual spring membership drive. It's that time of year where KBOO is all abuzz, and we need you to come jive with our radio hive. Help us reach our $56,000 goal and keep the hive alive. Just go to kboo.fm/give or mail a check to the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. And thanks!
This is From the Vault, the Pacifica Radio Archive's original weekly series that showcases some of the amazing recordings in our 55,000 program collection going back to 1949. I'm your host, Mark Torres. On this week's From the Vault, we present a relatively new addition to our collection, a panel discussion at the J. Paul Getty Museum entitled, See What You Mean, An Evening of Insurrections with Harry Gamboa, Jr. This panel was recorded on Saturday, October 28, 2017, and features several artists that help expand the role of California Latino and Chicano communities. First and foremost, the panel was convened to honor and showcase the life and work of photographer, performance artist, and educator Harry Gamboa Jr., who was just concluding his year-long artist in residency with the Getty. Harry Gamboa Jr. has been an important component of the Chicano community since co-founding the Latino artist collective ASCO, Spanish for nausea, based in East Los Angeles in 1972. Harry is also a world-class photographer. His photographs are in the permanent collections at the Smithsonian Portrait Gallery and the American Artist Museum in Washington, D.C., the Whitney Museum of American Art in New York, the Autry Museum in Los Angeles, and many others. Harry Gamboa Jr. is dedicated to passing along his knowledge and vision to the next generation as an instructor currently at the California Institute of the Arts, or CalArts, and dozens of other universities across the country and the world. This panel also features other members of the Latino and Chicano communities, including painter Ramiro Gomez, artist and archivist Guadalupe Rosales, and moderated by UCLA ethnomusicologist and author Chon Noriega. This event was produced by and recorded at the J. Paul Getty Museum. The Getty's Kathy Carpenter introduces the event.
I'm Kathy Carpenter. I'm Senior Public Program Specialist here at the Getty. And on behalf of the J. Paul Getty Museum, I would like to welcome you to See What You Mean, An Evening of Insurrections with Harry Gamboa Jr. This program is one of the outcomes of a year-long collaboration with Gamboa, who is our 2017 Getty Artist Program Artist in Residence. The Getty Artist Program is part of the J. Paul Getty Museum's ongoing invitation to contemporary artists to respond to and engage with the Getty's collection, site, and public through the development of compelling and transformative programs. We begin this evening with the conversation between artists who explore the textures of Latin American identity and experience in Southern California, including, of course, Harry Gamboa Jr., an internationally recognized essayist, photographer, director, performance artist, who, since co-founding the influential art collective ASCO in 1972, has been skillfully employing humor, satire, guerrilla tactics, counterintuitive strategies to create work that documents and interprets the contemporary urban Chicano experience. Joining him is Guadalupe Rosales, the artist and social archivist behind the popular Instagram archives, including Veteranas and Rugas, which presents artifacts and memorabilia related to the Los Angeles Latino and Chicano youth culture of the 1990s. Through this work, Rosales deconstructs and reframes marginalized histories, offering a platform for conversation and self-representation. Also with us is painter Ramiro Gomez, whose work as a nanny in West Hollywood informed an artistic practice that documents the contributions of laborers and caregivers so often erased from the curated image of polished homes and flawless landscapes of Los Angeles, providing a meditation on class, wealth, and the individual contributions required to maintain the illusion of effortless luxury. The discussion is moderated by Chan Noriega, who, among other things, is the director of the UCLA Chicano Studies Research Center. He's a professor of cinema and media studies at UCLA and co-curator of Home, So Different, So Appealing, that was recently on view at LACMA and opening at the Museum of Fine Arts in Houston in November. Thank you.
What I found really fascinating is that while each artist really begins or in some ways focuses on different decades from the 70s to the 90s to the current decade, that they all had an underlying kind of project, as it were, of making the invisible visible. But what's really interesting is that they had very different strategies. You have Harry, who is vehemently kind of resisting social media. Guadalupe, who became LACMA's first Instagram artist in residence. And Ramiro, who's in some ways kind of gone back to traditional art forms of cardboard paintings and of collage. And I thought this would be just a good chance to kind of kick around almost at the level of strategizing. How does one, what are the possibilities in this current moment of fake news, of the inability to really appreciate and support freedom of expression, particularly when engaged in by football players. So with that in mind, I'd like to just maybe start with a little bit of an opening gambit where you can each say a little bit about kind of where your work is now and what it is you're trying to do in terms of really bringing out that element that can't be seen. Because I think so much of what is being done in the, what we can call broadly the Chicano arts, is in one way or another getting people to see something that they currently don't see because there is an act of cultural blindness, or that they don't want to see because it conflicts too much with their own comfort zone. And so I want to just start with that. I'll begin. Harry, I wonder if you could just start. I've probably known you the longest. The very first time I met you, you shot me outside of Philippe's as part of what was a new project at the time called Chicano Male Unbonded.
Right. Maybe starting backwards. So as of today, my fotonovelas have been completed for the Getty. But I've been very interested in fotonovelas since I was a very young boy. I used to read comic books in the 1950s. And during the 1950s, the American superhero was really still dealing with the horrors of World War II. But in these comic books, the level of literature was much higher than what was being taught at the public schools. And so I was first introduced to theories related to physics, to dictatorships, to mass movements, to unions, and the idea of what would happen if the world were to simply to cease to exist. And yet, whenever I picked up a Spanish language fotonovela, they were highly sexualized. Everything was very extreme. And the mixture of the two produced a combination of fission and fusion reaction psychologically in me to go and seek out a way of explaining what I was living through, which I've continued to do ever since, actually, which put me at odds with society early on. And I had to reinvent that even to make it so that I would survive long enough to be able to continue to make comments. And so I find that fotonovelas, as Ruben Ortiz Torres mentioned quite recently, that he asked me, why am I dealing in a dead language? And I said, well, you know, part of it for the Getty is that if we get it on the internet, on the website, It might stay on for another 50 years, 100 years, and by that time, all the young people that are performing will be referred to as antiquities. And so,
I'm very familiar with the feeling of Chicano antiquities, but yes. We'll come back to this, because I am fascinated by taking what is really a visual kind of form of kind of mass circulation imagery that's before the internet. I'd like to turn to Guadalupe in terms of Instagram and the, not just the use of social media. I mean, there are issues in terms of social media now where it's very easily co-opted in ways that go beyond the old power structures. But I'm also interested in terms of the other side of your work, which is you're really kind of straddling a line between an artist and an archivist. Mm-hmm. And if you could say a little bit about that and why bringing that social media to bear on the 1990s.
Yeah, well, when I started the page, I was looking for something that was accessible to a lot of people and easy to use. And for a long time, I was against, you know, Instagram and definitely not Facebook. And but I gave it a lot of thought, and I thought more about photography. You know, like Instagram focuses on photography, and again, a lot of people are familiar with photography, and we all have some, either whether they're selfies or photos from their grandparents or when they were teenagers. But I was mostly focused or interested in the physical photograph. And I started the Instagram because I felt like, even from a personal take on that, there was like a part of history that wasn't necessarily lost, but it was not visible or misrepresented, which is the 90s, the part, you know, the time when I was a teenager. People knew about, you know, like the pachucos and lowriders and all that stuff, but I felt like there was more than that for a person that grew up in East LA, Boyle Heights. And when I started the Instagram, I wanted to have these conversations with the people that experienced this history, and share their own stories in a way that it's more like a first person experience rather than someone doing research on the history.
Can you say a little bit about how you situate that? And I'll, part of that is to kind of riff off of Harry's work and Osco's work in the 70s. There was a big social movement going on then. The battle lines were pretty clearly drawn. The stakes were pretty explicit. There were a series of demands and a series of rejections. And part of what Harry and Osco more generally bring in is the fact that that generation that's out there protesting is also highly assimilated within American culture as well, and also familiar with Mexican culture. And so they're working at these two crossroads rather than pushing for one versus the other. 90s, this is following the Reagan era. It's a very different kind of environment. And a lot of what gets documented in the 70s is, in effect, a party scene. I mean, this is kind of a social movement, and the social part is equally emphasized as the movement part. What about the political stakes in the 90s? Is there, or is this really about cultural history?
No, definitely. I mean, we were doing, you know, organizing events, parties, all ditching parties, in the midst of you know, we had just had the LA riots. Mm-hmm. The schools were not like probably not the best place to be at. You know, I remember going to high school and maybe like half the class would show up to class, you know, mm-hmm. and then having a substitute teacher in every class. And so for me, it was like, why would I be interested in going to a classroom that's half empty, you know? And also, we were also organizing school walkouts because of that reason, you know? Like, I remember my school wanted to remove the lockers because they thought that it was a waste of money. And I mean, if you guys remember, like, the books were really heavy at the time. I don't know if they still are, but you know, we were carrying backpacks. Yeah. Like,
what books? They got rid of that budget, by the way.
You know, and like little things like that, you know, just like they removed band, choir, photography, all these things that were really important to us. Mm-hmm. So there was definitely a lot of going on.
I mean, it seems in terms of, you know, following your work that there's a different vein to it than, say, situating something within a political movement, and then you kind of move out to the cultural. I think, in some ways, Osco did this as well. You flip that to say the cultural is always at the center of anything that can be eventually at some point identified as a political or social movement. Mm-hmm. Right? So I'm going to say this just because I hang out with Harry too much and he inspires me to have really bad puns, but what you were saying kind of raised the question, is the class half empty or half full?
So. I don't know.
bad pun. Ramiro, I guess I'm going to start prefacing by saying that at the earlier part of this decade, you also began as an artist in residence, but as a pun as well, you are in residence as a nanny in a home in Beverly Hills, and out of that really develop a form that's both new and old, and that gets at some of these same issues of what is it that we see all the time, and yet we also don't see something that's very critical to that. And if you could say a little bit about that and an art practice emerging out of that notion of residence, of the upper middle class home.
Yeah, it's interesting because I could identify with both Harry and Lupe's, you know, engagement with photography, but at the same time, as a nanny, a live-in nanny, my job primarily was of taking care of the kids. Responsibility was being active, present, working, and photography, cell phones, for example, were looked down upon. It's like, what are you doing on your phone when you should be taking care of my kids? I got away with little things. I mean, you know, the artist side of me was still there. I did not take the job as an artist, for example. I took it from necessity. But while I was there living with the family, questions would come up. I mean, looking around throughout the day, I'd be working at the home, and the only other people of color that I would see would be the people coming in to clean, to garden, to, you know, help around the house. And it was interesting to engage with them throughout the day, sort of like coworkers in a job that doesn't really have that. It's very independent. The kids were my coworkers. Yeah, changing diapers got a little
coffee
really
break.
Quick. No, but I do get back to the Instagram or the social media component, though, because I did get away with a very specific thing that I was able to do. Twitter, when it was coming around, I started a little handle called The Manny Diaries, and it was just me basically throughout my day just tweeting something. I didn't reveal my name. I had a little drawing. And that little idea of just tweeting throughout the day something, I don't know, pun or riff off of like popular songs at the time, like Chris Brown's Look At Me Now. It was like, look at me now. Look at me now. Hey, I'm changing diapers, you know? That kind of thing allowed for me to let go of something in a creative way, but I still was struggling with how to create visual components about it. You know, I didn't know how to say that kind of experience that I was doing to a mass audience outside of just something like Twitter. I don't know. And then eventually, I think I did arrive at that kind of response and visual language that I was able to employ where you see them. You see the nannies coming around all parts of the city, and the gardeners and the workers coming in and out of sections like the Beverly Hills community here or Brentwood, the west to the east transfer, the fact that during the day, the city is so, or this side of the city is so different, and everybody's shifting without really chatting or talking. You know, those cars move back and forth. And we all see that, but is it documented? Mm-hmm. Is it recorded? That's a concern for me, for sure. It's, you know, we see it, and as I was working with these people, working with them is one thing, but also the realization that they would be able to be dismissed at any moment. Like myself, you know, my job was on the line at any moment. People would come into the house, again, a very specific experience of a domestic worker, housekeeper, that would come in every Thursday. And I got used to talking to her, hanging out with her every day, or every Thursday. And then one Thursday, she just didn't show up to work. And I'm wondering what happened to her. We had bonded. And by the next Thursday, there was a whole new person, and I still have no idea whatever happened to this person. You know, it's rough, and that goes back to my material choice now is ephemerality and the temporariness, the impermanence of the job, the impermanence of labor. Cardboard is a perfect material to explore for that reason.
Now, I'll note this, and then I'll ask you a brief question about cardboard. Your collage work at that time, which is taking magazines, these home magazines that came into the house, I gather, and that had these wonderful photos of kitchens and living rooms with furniture or appliances you could buy, and you kind of started painting those in, and you were inspired by Picasso. You was coming across his collage work, which was your first trip out of the U.S., I think.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, because again, magazines would be around the house as I was working. So that Twitter handle was one way of expressing my day-to-day job. Mm-hmm. But then when I would look at those magazines, like Lux, Dwell, just sitting around the house, I remember looking at them going, wow, these pictures look just like the home I'm working in, but they're not including anybody that I see working with me. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it took a lot of just practice and just sort of sketching and random things and exploration to arrive to the point where I was inserting with paint the figures, like a housekeeper, a gardener, into those pictures, very small, ripping the magazine, responding to it, intervening in an image that, again, erases or chooses not to focus on it, and yet sells a lifestyle that employs all of us, that creates the demand for labor and childcare and home care. So, yeah, at first that practice was done in my break time. So again, when I was working with the children, I found little ways to do it.
You don't owe royalties, huh?
Yeah. But just ripping the magazine helped, getting it out quickly, and then the kids would wake up, so I didn't really have time. I worked within my constraints, and then eventually sharing that with people, getting people's attention with it, has become the point of it all.
I want to move to cardboard because I want to pivot to the question of action. We've talked about rumor, photography, but at around the same time, your partner was working on set design at CSI, one of those CSIs, or Law & Orders, one of those shows.
Criminal Minds.
Criminal Minds.
Assistant editor, yeah.
And he'd come home with these large pieces of leftover cardboard, and he'd start doing human-sized cutouts of workers, and then placing them around Beverly Hills and photographing them, and then seeing how long they stayed up. Can you say a little bit about that as an action? What were you trying to achieve?
You know what, as I mentioned, the magazine is so small, it's so personal and intimate. Sharing it at the time, Instagram wasn't really around, so an image was hard to like share with a mass people. Again, the Twitter at the same time was just so text-driven that I didn't feel that I could really get the message out there. So that cardboard component actually was born, as I said, from seeing the images, replacing it, instead of just painting it on the magazine, painting on cardboard and going right into those environments. Guerrilla style. I do note that there was things around the time like Banksy's Exit Through the Gift Shop that came out, and street art all over Melrose and Fairfax and things that was inspiring to me to get out. But I'm very uncomfortable with going in, quote unquote, damaging a building and being susceptible to that kind of, target that would limit sometimes creativity in some ways. Mm-hmm. And in others, it was just my strategy. Nobody was doing street art in Beverly Hills, so.
you saw an open market here.
I mean, it was just natural. You see the gardeners there in front of those homes, and it was just a way to like allow for people to contemplate. It's hard to get someone to stare at the gardener. That's uncomfortable for both the gardener and the viewer. But if you make a painting of a gardener, all of a sudden there's a space that's created through a visual component for somebody to say, oh, wait, I pass this all the time, but I don't really think about it. So let me think about it.
And so we met in 2011, and we archived digital images of some of those actions. And then in 2013, we wanted to invite Ramiro in to do some similar works around the campus, and facilities said no, there's too much liability. So Ramiro did actually a to-scale recreation of the truck and a facilities person, and put it out in front of the building. We're not to be deterred.
I remember that. It was like my way, said, we're not really going to sanction this, but, I just took it.
So, Harry, Ramiro's thrown down the gauntlet here. What about damaging buildings?
What?
Yeah.
Well,
I hear they're going to tear one of them down next year. They're on their on Wilshire.
Yeah. So, I know that when the Osco show opened up, everyone wanted to find to strip away the paint of where we had spray painted, but that bridge has been gone. You know, maybe one of the things I wanted to kind of touch on, maybe with my connection with the fotonovelas, is that these fotonovelas were designed to be viewable on telephones and all your phones. They're all very digitized, which is a form of ephemerality on some level. But we live in a time where people are into, there's an imposition of forced ephemerality. That is, you can be made to disappear at any time. We have a current system where little children being wheeled out of a hospital room with cerebral palsy are being arrested, where you can have people declared less than human just simply because people have a badge. This, of course, calls back to the way I grew up. I mean, I wrote an article once for a publication out of CalArts called East of Borneo, in which I explained I was standing on a street corner once when 25 police officers opened fire with the shotguns and emptied all their weapons into the crowd. And many people died, and many people were wounded. But of course, when the newspapers came out, they said one person was killed and only three people were injured. And that's kind of been the history with the media for many years. And so for me, I grew up also during the time of the Vietnam War, where all of my friends have been dead since I've been 19 years old. They were made to disappear. And now we have a whole population that's disappearing due to opioids and all kinds of things. And so the system itself is designed to make people disappear and to become ephemeral. And that's not art. That's, you know, that's an assault on humanity. And so I'm interested in commenting on works that really do touch on maybe some of the original themes that I saw in the comic strips that referred to maybe World War II and the Nazi era, in which the ideas were never defeated. They were actually simply just adopted and transferred, and a different flag was placed upon them. And so, and we live in an era where most work is actually digitized and it's registered in temporary memory, so that everyone forgets what they just looked at because the next image is, has appeared. And so it requires all of us to generate work that's not only ephemeral, but the work that's permanent also. And this sense of permanence is also subject to permeability, which means we all bleed, we all can, you know, age. And so in the end, it's ideas that we share through our work that's very important, but it's also the ideas are designed to influence young people to possibly have a recognition that they are able to be creative also, and to actually, they need to really fight for themselves and to support the rest of us. And so we are here in the Getty, that's sort of the hilltop. But in a way, I think it's a perfect venue for the rest of the world to take a look at maybe just as some of the examples of what Chicanos can produce, even though our presence here is ephemeral also.
You're listening to a panel called See What You Mean, An Evening of Insurrections with Harry Gamboa Jr., featuring Harry Gamboa, painter Ramiro Gomez, artist Guadalupe Rosales, and moderated by UCLA ethnomusicologist and author Chon Noriega. If you would like to find out more about the From the Vault series, go to fromthevaultradio.org. If you would like to browse our entire 50,000 program collection, go to pacificaradioarchives.org. And now we return to the panel discussion recorded October 28th, 2017, at the J. Paul Getty Museum, An Evening of Insurrections with Harry Gamboa Jr.
There's the analytical side of what you're saying, which is an observation that of certain strategies that have been used over the 20th century to basically render invisible or disappeared, the term often used, elements of society that are seen as undesirable or as complicating things.
Yeah.
But what is the flip side of that in terms of what is possible now to challenge that? In the 70s, you had three TV stations and then public TV, whatever that was, and you had two newspapers in most cities, and the strategy was to how do you intervene in those?
Right.
You're never going to get them on your side, but how do you disrupt that? And I think that, you know, you're part of a generation that really came up with very creative and kind of crafty ways of doing that. Now we've got 500 channels. We have half a newspaper, the Los Angeles, the Lost Times, you know. It's like the Angeles part dropped out. It's basically a newsletter now. And social media platforms that give the illusion of access to communication, there's too much almost.
Yeah.
And it's all controlled by the Russians. So what can we do now beyond the orientation that you outlined, the world view that you describe? Where are the pressure points that you see in terms of your work?
I think part of it is to understand that we have to be resilient and brilliant and utilize our own bodies as understand that we actually exist as imagery. And every time we have the opportunity to become an image, that within that image is embedded some kind of a message. And that message should convey whatever it is your belief system is in relation to protecting your integrity as a human being. Mm-hmm. And by doing that, you actually protect others. And because we have it coming the other way, in which people are denounced, people are eliminated, people are reduced to being non-entities. And there's so much technology and different types of approaches to basically eradicate human beings, both as being in the present and the past, and the possibility of us ever really attaining any level of a future. And so one thing that I do want to say, that as with most of the work that I do now, rather than being angry, we laugh. We have a really great time. It's always, the party has continued since I've been quite young, and I encourage people to laugh, because in laughter you diminish their power and you take back your power. And so that's basically where the work is now. It's all through satire and to reverse engineer the kind of language that's used against us, to put a stop to it and to assert our own right to be here forever.
You know, almost 20 years ago, I think right around this time, you and I sat in a Starbucks for about 5-6 hours going through the copy editings of Urban Exile, which is an 800-page collection of, you know, fairly overwhelmingly horrific kind of descriptions of violence, structured violence in our society. But we laughed basically through all six espressos that we drank.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think you capture that. And the other thing is the image. And I'll just note, if you all look at Harry now, that camera that's draped around his neck has been there for about 43 years.
Yes.
And it really came from an initial insight, though, and he realized that the press and the police had pictures, the Chicano community did not. Now, along with that, something you said really resonated with the impact that Guadalupe's work has had, which is the recirculation of images that were initially private. They were part of home photo albums and personal collections of images. But the presence of those images, the ability to circulate them, really just caught on with the press in a way that was both gratifying and surprising. And I wonder if you could say a little bit about that and what follows that, which is you become LACMA's first, and probably only at this point, Instagram artist in residence. Talk about that transition into the museum context. Mm-hmm.
The way I use Instagram is not just posting the photo. It's not just showing someone's photograph, but there's some sort of dialogue that happens before I post a photo. I build some sort of relationship with the person that sends me the photo. And the reason for that is because I'm really interested in not censoring someone's history or stories, and that's how I'm using the platform. And whatever I add on the caption, it's not like what I want to say about the photo. It's what they want to say about mm-hmm. themselves. Mm-hmm. And I think that's also really important in a way that if we want to be visible and represent it the way we feel comfortable is by sharing these stories. You know, it's like if someone sends me a photo of themselves at a party, I ask them, what do you want to say about this photo? And then I post, you know. Entering LACMA's platform, I was really interested in having this crossover conversation with people who were not familiar with the work that I was doing. They weren't necessarily people of color, but they may have some sort of like similar history. And I have to say that it was really, there were a lot of challenging moments when I entered LACMA's platform. For example, there's a photo that I added to the slideshow where it's four women standing in Boyle Heights on the 6th Street Bridge. And there's a comment where a woman, I'm pretty sure it was a woman because I went back and saw who it was. And she pretty much said, and now I will unfollow this Instagram, which she's talking about LACMA's page. Because women like these made my life miserable in high school, and and so I left the comment. I mean, I was really pissed off, you know, and I didn't know what to do. Should I leave it? Should I block her? Should I what? And I just left it. And I'm glad that I did because a lot of people, you know, responded to that comment, and she ended up looking like a racist person, you know, who was profiling four young women standing in Boyle Heights on mm-hmm. 60 Bridge. It's still there, so if you guys want to go check it out, it's still there. And that's what's really interesting about social media, that it's not just a photo, but it's also the comments that happen.
Yeah. Well, we've seen a lot of this with museums withdrawing, in some cases, you know, destroying works, rather than really allowing for a very difficult conversation to take place, mm-hmm. For allowing things to appear on the platform or in the galleries that are maybe hated as much as they are loved. And I'm wondering, you've opened an interesting question in terms of the role of art, not just in terms of circulating images, not just of presenting people with the hard fact of being physically present in their fantasies, whether they like it or not, the way that Ramiro's work is done and Harry's work, but that this is also an occasion to allow those images to bring a voice into mm-hmm. discussion that's not part of the discussion that we have through our mainstream media, through our mainstream museums. I'm intrigued with the way you've taken that, and you've done some Instagram tours as well. And if you could, is there something more to say about that in terms of you've become an almost unheard of voice within the space of the comprehensive art museum and speaking to an audience that many museums have never really thought of mm-hmm. as their audience.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. And I mean, I've also learned that even like our people, our raza, will dictate and censor our own culture. Mm-hmm. And that's something that I see on my own page, you know, like people who like might say something negative about a photograph and I think for me it was about disrupting that and reframing our own history, not just on my page but also in a platform that is an institution's platform, and have these conversations outside of this of like Veteranas and Rucas. Mm-hmm. And it was about challenging the world, I would say, you know, and for example, using this image of four young women, like what she was saying, what this person was saying about this photograph is also like information that we get fed through television, through the radio, you know, saying like Chicanos or Latinos from LA are criminals, are mm-hmm. cholos, you know, and for me, like collectively, we are disrupting that and saying like we're more than that, you know, so.
Since we're in an arts context, part of that is how do you bring that into an art museum that doesn't really have any categories for that? It's got key figures, periods, regions, but there's less familiarity with how do you bring in work that is really speaking to frames of reference that are completely alien to what's been in the museum before. And I don't know if each of you have something to say in that regard. I know, Ramiro, your work went from really being very much of the moment and tied to the ephemerality that was part of your strategy to now entering into major collections, both in terms of paintings, your cardboard mural, which is now in the LACMA collection. What is there to say about that transition of getting into the museum as a very particular kind of social site, which is very different than, say, mass media or occupying the public square?
You know, I definitely have a lot of experience now within the last year with various institutions. I mean, LACMA is one, but the year started with a project at the Denver Art Museum, for example, that I was invited to last year, and opened earlier this year in March or February. But that project took a whole year, and they invited 13 artists of Latin American descent, they called it. 13 artists though, working in the Southwest around different issues, and my work and my strategies here in the Los Angeles area, you know, picked their interest. But when I was invited, they were looking at it from the West Hollywood work, you know, the nanny work like you see behind me. They were very interested in my cardboard work, but at the same time, the institution brought me in and said, you know, we like your impermanence and your cardboard, but the show's gonna run from February through November. Can you think about something a little more permanent? And at first I was rejecting. I was like, no, you know what? This is my strategy, this is what I'm gonna do. And then I had set precedents. I said to them, you know, what I do in Los Angeles sticks to Los Angeles because that's where I live, that's what I see every day. Whereas in Denver, I don't know anything about it. So I need to be in Denver observing the city here. I need to be in the museum, looking at the museum itself. And so what I chose to do was focus on the janitors there. Mm-hmm. Again, the impermanence aspect was brought up, and I decided once I looked through things like, you know, the janitors working at the museum and making connections and bonding with one specific named Lupita. Lupita was very friendly and very positive and actually very excited by the idea of me focusing on paintings about her. But it was an interesting dynamic that was playing out. So as a custodial worker, she's actually contracted or subcontracted. She's not employed directly by the museum. And those little things would come out as I was observing and seeing the logo on her t-shirt. And as I brought up this impermanence idea, but bringing out more you know, things to the museum curators, they started becoming very concerned about logo use. And the idea of focusing on the janitor all of a sudden became uncomfortable. Well, I decided to focus right on that and on the logo. I mean, what else is there to do, right? And then as far as the impermanence concern and the cardboard aspect, I debated it, I struggled with it, and I decided instead of the cardboard, why not something more permanent, as Harry was saying? And I decided to do bronze, and especially keeping the cardboard component live, casting the cardboard cutouts and putting them outside of the museum where I saw her working, leaving her there, leaving her exposed, her image exposed, as she is exposed in general. It's an interesting thing, too. I want to highlight that when I met Lupita in September of 2016, by November, the museum had switched the contract out. Mm. And I didn't know that as the artist. I was sort of surprised by that. And Lupita was no longer working there. Mm. She didn't transition to the new contractor very well, and she was left to struggle. And it was ironic as an artist being invited, and then I started wrestling with that idea of the object and the presence of her and myself as the artist. And that's something that I still struggle with. The bronzes are there, the show just closed, but all the cardboard components that were part of it inside that I maintained, paintings of her, showed her history, showed her dynamic throughout the period, not just as a laborer, but at the same time, an image inside is of her 21st birthday, surrounded by her family. And it's about presence and at the same time expanding somebody's expression, not just the janitor. They have families, they have lives. And it was very powerful to have the object, but now the cardboard pieces, four of which were very special photographs that Lupita shared with me of her family members that are no longer around, that have since passed away or deported. And now those four little cardboard paintings I'm giving to her as a way to control and combat, because again, the Denver Art Museum, you know, as an institution, yes, I appreciate being invited, but at the same time, my artwork and my, you know, my transitions and my struggles are still there as an artist. And how do we engage with control of art? How do we engage with all of that within the space? I mean, I think we just follow our intuition. That's what I did.
It's interesting because it's easy to, in talking about artists, disconnect from the fact that it's not just an object or an image and a viewer, but it's also connected to a set of social relations. And I know when we did a show of your work, one of your early shows we did at the Chicano Studies Research Center, and we had to wait until your mother and father could get there, and they were stuck in traffic. Your mother was working as a janitor, your dad as a truck driver. Yeah. I think they got there around 7 o'clock.
Yeah, they're in San Bernardino, and my dad and my mom never miss a show, especially at SoCal. In fact, today they would be here, but tomorrow they're doing a menudo for my family, you know, the good stuff. And I'm like, I'm not going to compete. My mom's in charge of menudo.
You can't mess with a menudo, man.
Her image is up here in one of the slideshows, by the way. I took a photo of her working, and, you know, I love including her. So she's still here, you know.
So Harry, you have some work up at the Autry now that you haven't seen from the Chicano Mail and Bonded, but that's also part of an acquisition by the museum.
Yeah.
Into that. I mean, you could just ruminate a little bit on that process.
Well, much of my photographic work, going all the way back to 1972, anything that was color was actually shot on chrome 35 millimeter slides, never actually printed. They existed as light being projected. Black and white.
Cheaper to put through a slide projector.
Yep, absolutely. And the black and white, again, sort of the approach to make the work has been very selective. Also has to do a little bit with just focusing on making things. But the Chicano Mail and Bonded series began in 1991. I was actually having... joined a lot of people. They were very in a celebratory mood for having accomplished some event. And I heard a lot of very optimistic talk, but, you know, I was living in East LA at the time and saw a few things that didn't match exactly what they were all celebrating. And when I got into my car, I turned on the radio. And the first thing that went on the radio was, and be on the lookout, he's a Chicano male. And I went to commercial. And where I immediately thought of the kinds of things I'd seen in my life, that all of a sudden all my relatives were in trouble. My father, my brothers, my son, myself, and all my colleagues, all my friends.
And don't forget Professor Noriega, right?
Yeah, and of course. And by the way, I met Professor Noriega before he had his PhD, so not Professor yet.
Yeah, yeah.
So anyway, I decided that I would photograph the various men who I felt in some way or another had impacted me, who were Chicano specifically, who would fall under the category of being hunted down by the police or the authorities. But I kept thinking about all the different men who have influenced me in one way or another through their integrity, some action, some moment, some stylistic attitude, attribute that they had, some heroic feat maybe that would went unnoticed for me, but in some way instructed me to kind of continue on. And so I actually started photographing a handful of people at the time. I wasn't very clear on the formulation of the posturing and all that, but I was thinking about how would you encounter a Chicano man at night. And of course, I've had the experience myself where I've had too many police guns pointed at me in my lifetime and other kinds of people threatening me, and how I was able to get away, but how many of my other friends never made it away. That was their last moment. And so I wanted to photograph the various men in a location in Los Angeles originally, but I wanted them to look very much in a film noir style, actually. So I used available light, I used high-speed film, had them usually, I would ask them to wear something dark, I would pre-select the location, thinking I was going to get it all done in a month, but I've been doing this project since 1991, and at the Autry Museum, there's 84 photographs that date from 1991 all the way to the present, and I believe in the room we have a handful of the men that were photographed. The Autry Museum acquired 4. The National Portrait Gallery has 4. They're not in too many institutional collections, and actually all the men who have posed for me are given one of the prints in an edition of six. And the Osco work, for instance, has received international attention, has appeared in many publications, on the covers of magazines, and maybe the only American museum that's actually purchased that has been the Whitney Museum of Art. And
El Museo del Barrio.
And the Museo del Barrio purchased the original set that, again, wasn't actually fixed in the current version of what gets shown. But they do have a small collection.
That was at a show at the Pompidou.
Yeah, that was shown at the Pompidou.
You're the only Chicano entry in that.
Yeah, the Pompidou actually had a really interesting approach to me. They specifically asked me to print them to specific size. They wanted to have the images of the scratch slides printed on a pristine paper, new print, and so it's you could barely see the images, actually, that were shown at the Pompidou, and they say, Mouchik, you know, but I had sort of some interesting responses from some very established artists here in L.A. who approached me then and asked me why I bothered to take the opportunity show, because they felt that it would go nowhere for me. And why was I taking away a slot from them? And and I've been around a long time, by the way, and I made my early 20s and 30s was fighting with everybody who's really famous now. And if I'm going to be shot at with by police, I'm not going to be afraid of anyone saying to me. So but again,
that goes straight on a button, Harry.
Yes, absolutely. That's the next button. But as it turns out, of course, it's all about attitude and being assertive and not being angry. It's about being assertive, insisting that you belong and being a participant. It's never about rejecting participation. It's about reminding people that we absolutely need to be included, because otherwise your spectrum is incomplete.
Yeah. Well said. So I think what we'll do is wrap that up with a final quick round focused on L.A. Guadalupe, maybe you'll start us off. You're all three L.A.-ish natives. A lot of your work really digs deep into the day-to-day experience of the Chicano community in Los Angeles, which at this point, in terms of demographics, we could just call Los Angeles, the community of Los Angeles. And I wonder if you could just offer a thought about that in terms of LA as your studio.
Yeah, well, I see it as a studio, and I see my work as a collaboration with LA. Mm-hmm. So, and it just keeps getting bigger and bigger.
How is LA as a collaborator?
Intense. there's a lot to dig through, definitely. It's not just a flat surface.
Mm-hmm. Ramiro, your work in some ways comes up against and challenges the very notion of LA or the Hollywood region here, of which LA is a suburb, as a city of images.
That's the thing. Hollywood is full of imagery and images of people that I'm painting or figuring, but they're more caricatures of some sort. Mm-hmm. I'm very concerned with the ability to showcase the impermanence, as I said, of the job and the labor, but at the same time, I'm also very concerned with how the image is received, how it's seen. You know, there's things I let go of. There's things I'm not strategizing, I'm not, you know, specifically creating a narrative around this other than just reflecting what the city's already saying to me. Anywhere I go in the city, I see certain things happening, whether it's on the west side, like here, the custodial workers that you'll see right here cleaning up everything around us. You know, everything's very visible. And Hollywood is full of this, writers getting their inspiration from the city itself and reflecting, but I'll see movies like Woody Allen's movies that showcase them as background. The history's always full of this, the roles that are given to certain people that are trying to break into the industry, you know, automatically a gardener, a janitor. And it's interesting to me as a painter of that subject, how the facelessness, for example, is meant to be a universality of it all. No matter where you go in the world, the cast is different, but the roles are the same. So an image like my work here could be seen or read as Latino-centric, right? But when I worked, I wasn't just working with Latinos. There was Haitian women, Brazilian, Portuguese, Middle Eastern, all kinds of women, primarily women, working. I was very much in the minority, but I'm used to that. it's really interesting, and transitioning into institutions, as I said, is a struggle. It's an ongoing one that I'm willing to take on. Being at the Whitney and giving paintings to the workers there, being at the Denver Art Museum, like I said, and bonding with someone there, at LACMA, creating objects that I'm eventually going to give. People here working that I'm sure are inspiring as I'm taking photos and my husband out there taking photos that are going to inspire little gifts. And it's this way of going back into what I want to do, you know, always figuring out that the city gives me so much, so how can I give back? It's basic appreciation, and creating empathy is important to me. So,
Harry, we're going to end with you. You have 2 minutes. And I want you to do two things. You can divide the time any way you want. But the first is, you are in some ways the quintessential LA artist. Your work really contributes to that larger visual and textual discussion about LA as a city that in some ways helps us understand the modern world. But lately you've gone Northern European on us. And you've been traveling around the Nordic countries where they seem to have adopted you.
Yeah.
Made you one of their own, as it were. I think you're called Van Gamboa now.
Yeah.
You're collected in all of their major institutions. You have a separate troupe there, and I think I hope the folks here tonight don't feel jealous, but he's got a Northern European counterpart to you all.
Right.
So if you could say a little bit about that, being an LA artist who's gone over to where it all began, in one sense. And then, as a way of ending, could you just tell us what we're in for the rest of the night with the insurrection?
Okay, so the trooper performers, at this point, maybe for 15 years, worked under the title of Virtual Verite. That particular troupe has been dissolved as an entity, but the performers continue to exist as a group, as an entity. I work with people all throughout Northern Europe and in Mexico City also. So maybe there's about another 50 people that perform for me. I was actually in Belgium, and we transform a whole group of people into becoming human barriers. We stopped traffic in the streets, and we would quit every time the soldiers showed up with bayonets. But the idea is that I have the Europeans perform Chicano concerns. And of course, the Chicano concerns actually are European concerns because they're actually the worldwide concerns. And you go to Mexico City and they're quite the same. And it's all about legitimizing life, your own lives, and the right to live peacefully and free from harm, and to actually be able to survive within your own city. And so for me, Los Angeles has always been the perfect place because nothing's ever the same. It's constantly undergoing shifting of all sorts. And it requires one to be very adaptable and to break tradition because traditions get locked down, but they're constantly drifting apart with tectonic shifts and population changes and attitudes. And because of the media, we all speak basically the same language. And you go anywhere, I usually travel without a phone or a map. I get off and I get lost for the first day, and now I know that city. And besides that, if I ask anybody in whatever foreign country I'm in, it's always in English, and they will always respond in English, and they usually speak English better than people from here. But my concern also is to serve as an example of maybe I do feel that I'm a representative of the Chicano community and also as an American in showing positiveness and the fact that it's really possible to make something out of nothing and to add substance to the general mirage.
This has been From the Vault, the original series produced by the Pacifica Radio Archives. You've been listening to the panel discussion called See What You Mean, An Evening of Insurrections with Harry Gamboa Jr., featuring Harry Gamboa, painter Ramiro Gomez, artist Guadalupe Rosales, and moderated by UCLA ethnomusicologist and author Chon Noriega. If you would like to find out more about the From the Vault series, go to fromthevaultradio.org. If you would like to browse our entire 50,000 program collection, go to pacificaradioarchives.org. Thank you to the J. Paul Getty Museum for allowing us to record this and present this to you today. The theme song is an original composition written by Nancy Sanchez and Gina Recamier. Thank you for listening and helping keep our history alive.
You're listening to KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM and streaming on the web, kboo.fm. I'm Don Jacobson, and moving on, we'll be here in just a few minutes right after the news.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7 FM. Hoy viernes 29 de abril del 2022. Los bloqueos para detener un número creciente de brotes del COVID-19 han entorpecido la logística y aumentado el desempleo en toda China, lo que llevó a los líderes del país a ordenar esta semana una amplia gama de medidas para evitar que la economía se desacelere aún más. Muchas empresas podrán dejar de pagar el seguro de desempleo al gobierno siempre que eviten despidos masivos. Se reducirán las tarifas de electricidad e internet para las empresas.